The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in the new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample and we're stood outside the London Science Museum, home of one of the world's largest and most valuable collections of iconic objects from science and technology. We're here to meet Ian Blatchford, director of the Science Museum, who's going to give us a bit of a private tour and show us some of his favourite things from the museum, but also to answer a crucial question, and that is, what is the role of a science museum and how must that change in the future? Ian, what is the role of a science museum today?
I think it's to encourage people to think about the future by understanding its context. So the thing that I find quite depressing about a lot of science museums, or indeed the way people talk about science museums, is that they think there's a huge gulf between contemporary science practice and the history of science, as if somehow the history of science is not very interesting and should be sort of locked in a cupboard. But when you talk to real scientists, that's not how they see it. They see two things that are really crucial about a museum. One is it helps people understand how discoveries were made in the past, the personalities involved, and what we can learn about creative and brilliant science, but also how problems reemerge. The example I sometimes give is that we've just put on display in the museum one of the world's first electric cars, and people assume that electric cars are a modern technology. This is completely untrue. At the beginning of the 20th century, it could have gone either way. It was either the combustion engine or the battery. And for various reasons, the battery solution didn't work. But it's fascinating how problems repeat. And similarly, if you think of us having undoubtedly the world's greatest medical collection, there are so many issues there. Ethical issues about the way society makes choices that are the same now as they were in the 1500s or the 1800s. So to use a wonderful phrase that a historian once gave me, museums are the hinge of history. And what they mean is that it's where relevant historical collections and modern challenges sort of meet and can be understood better.
In a really blunt and ugly way, you might say that a museum really is a place where you put old stuff relevant to the topic of the museum. Here you keep iconic aspects of and objects of science and technology. But do you see that the museum has to become something much more than that?
I think your parody of what we are would be true if we didn't do other things. So the museum is not just about the permanent things on display, it's also about the programs and exhibitions we do. And one of the things that is very striking when we talk to our visitors, if we do an exhibition, for example, about climate science, or about GM crops, or about challenges in biology, we are regarded as speaking with particular authority because we have the great historic collections. So there's something that's really precious about a museum is that our visitors feel we have an authenticity and authority because, in fact, being historians, we want to know what the truth is and we research things properly. So although you could easily do those exhibitions anywhere, there's something a bit magical. And, you know, the reason I say that is that one of the most important computer technologists in the world was once going around the museum with me, and I wanted to talk to him about what we were saying about modern computing and the challenge of children being better at maths. And he stopped me in the middle of what I thought was an appropriate speech and said, "That's all true, but the reason it has an impact when you do it is that in order to get to the exhibition, they walk through the world's greatest collection of steam engines." And this man said that he told his children that had the steam engine not existed, there wouldn't have been an industrial revolution. So here's someone who's made billions from modern technology who gets a museum rather brilliantly. And so I think he makes the case for me.
Are there things you want to do differently in the future with the Science Museum? Any a vision you have for how it should go?
Well, I think there are two things that, three things actually, I would say are priorities for me. And the first is thinking about who we're trying to talk to, because the thing I find really, really depressing, almost soul-destroying, is the assumption that you come across in almost every science museum in the world, which is that they have one simple mission, which is to inspire children. And of course, that is a vital part of what we do. And in fact, I speak from a position of strength because we have more schools groups coming here than any other museum in the country. But if we really want to raise science literacy and get people talking about science in a different way, it's just as important that we have people here in their 20s and 30s. And also, as I love to provoke people, what about people with grey hair? Because it matters in many ways. First of all of those people, generations are engaged in making decisions. But also, there's something very interesting that lurks in a lot of research about young children, which is when people decide whether they're going to become scientists or not, it's not just about whether they've got a good exam grade, it's also what their parents think and granny thinks and their cousins think. And, you know, the humanities have always understood this. So can you imagine, if I can put it this way, that if tomorrow morning the British Museum or the Tate decided that we only let children in, everyone would be outraged because they say that understanding civilization and art is for all generations. So if that's true, why is it not also true of the Science Museum? So the answer is, I'm determined that it should be. The other thing I'm passionate about is when I started here, I inherited a model which is common in a lot of science museums, which is very commercially driven exhibitions about science. And although they have a role, and things like, for example, the science of James Bond and the science of aliens, in the end, when you really talk to visitors, this is quite problematic, actually, because if a science museum is going to be powerful, first of all, it should use its great collections, but also it should do some really tough, proper science. And I don't think that's a problem because if you're adventurous in the way you display things, you can do some pretty amazing things. So I decided, probably rather insanely, that the first blockbuster we'll do in this new style is a big exhibition next year about the Large Hadron Collider. So I've chosen the most complicated science imaginable and the most invisible issues of atomic structure. But the point is that actually, if you think about it, it is possible because you talk not only about the physics, you also talk about the engineering, and also, going back to a theme I mentioned earlier, the personalities at CERN are simply wonderful. So that's a key thing. And then my final answer is I want far more of the historic collection on display. And to give you an example, we have the world's best collection of 18th and 19th century demonstration objects. So we have this wonderful collection of things that were made either for George III or they were made for great displays by the people like Faraday in that rather heroic era when science was so popular and lectures were completely crowded out. And I want to redisplay all of that and recreate some of the great experiments of the 19th century and introduce a degree of theatricality to the historical collections.
So speaking of some of those great objects, we're going to have the opportunity to see some of them. Let's have a look at the first of those.
So we're standing in a new exhibition space in the Science Museum, which celebrates the work of James Watt. The exhibition is also there about his partnership with Matthew Boulton, because, you know, Watt was very much a great engineer and inventor. Boulton was, you know, a brilliant entrepreneur, and between the two of them, it was the most blissful combination, the kind of dream combination that, you know, any economy wants. And the thing I'm standing by now is a print from the middle of the 19th century, which tells you something, I think, really quite profound about how different Britain's view of science and engineering was in the 19th century from today. So this is a print that would have been bought by, you know, schools and children, and also would have, you know, hung on walls in the front parlour. And it shows great moments of British history in the 19th century. And what's so interesting for me is that you have obvious things that we would expect, like the death of Nelson, American independence, the defeat of Sultan Tipu and the sudden success of the British Empire. But also, we have James Watt. And the point being that in the 19th century, Watt was seen unequivocally as, you know, one of the great heroes of British history. And what's very interesting about Britain in the 1860s and 70s is the thing that we now are very anxious about, which is the two cultures. No one would have any idea what you were talking about. And it's quite amazing how things have now changed. I mean, Watt, for many years, faded into the background. And so one of the reasons we're doing this is to remind people that when we talk about Britain being an inventive nation that makes things and makes money out of it, It's not a new idea. We were doing it rather brilliantly in the 19th century.
Why do you think there was no two cultures then? Why did he come into the sort of public consciousness so seamlessly?
I think one of the reasons is a rather shocking one in many ways, which is that one of the things that started to create the two cultures problem was the rise of the professional scientists, and particularly the growth of, you know, proper universities. The education system was much more fluid in the 19th century, and also you have to remember that the Industrial Revolution was such a fast-moving thing that trying to rationalize it and think about science in a different way was evolving all the time. I think the other thing that became a problem later on, particularly, I would say, the landmark moment is in many ways the First World War, because what's really striking about the whole of the 19th century is there's no real ambivalence about technology, that it's seen as an unquestionably good thing. You then get the First World War, where technology, it shows a really nasty dark side. And the reason I say that is that when this museum opened in 1909, its message was very optimistic and positive, and it had a massive crisis of confidence after the First World War, because suddenly all the public acceptance of the joy of science was really being questioned. So even though there were plenty of wars, of course, in the 19th century, people were less aware of the technology involved.
It's amazing that such a sort of small object in the corner of this huge museum with all of these exhibits can convey so much story and have so much historical importance. And that must be one of the challenges that you face as a museum, is how do you bring this to people?
Yeah, it's a great challenge, because you're dealing not only with differences in scale. So we've got enormous bits of technologies. Stevenson's rocket, for example, quite well known, after all, in the history of the world, but also vast collections in our library and archives of, for example, we have the entire collection of Charles Babbage's drawings for his various computer projects. And, we have 7.3 million things. And of that collection, about 200,000 are sort of big, meaty objects. But the rest are little things like this print, which, when you realize their significance, you see why they need to be displayed, but it's not obvious initially. So you have a sort of combination of things. That, of course, is what art museums are used to doing, giving the full context. Science museums, I think, are still catching up. The other thing I should say about this display is other prints around it also are very revealing, something else really important to remember about science, which is one of the things that the Victorians were very comfortable with, that we've become ambivalent about, is heroes. So the other big myth about Watt was that as a young boy, he spent hours watching a kettle boil and became obsessed by steam, and therefore it was his destiny, in a very Whiggish view of history, to invent, you know, the ultimate steam engine. But we may kind of laugh slightly about that, but it was incredibly important to the Victorians to have these great figures to be seen not just as role models in the language we now use, but as these great inspirations. And I think that one of the lessons I've also learned, which partly answers the question you asked me earlier, one of the ways you make sense of a collection is not just explaining its technology. The biggest thing that all our visitors say is they want to know about the personalities. They want to know about the personalities really before the science. Now, scientists get quite annoyed when I say that, because they think that a science museum should essentially be a textbook on the wall. But I promise you that the research we do with visitors is overwhelmingly in my favour, not theirs.
We've just left Watts's workshop, where there's an awful lot of objects to look at, a lot to see that he was creating or working on. And does this lead to a challenge for you in the future, with science becoming perhaps less visible, less tangible? You have all of these huge objects around the Science Museum, from the Apollo Command Module and Stevenson's rocket and such like. But a lot of modern science will be about genetic analysis. It'll be about electronics and so on. Does that become a tougher thing for you? Higgs bosons, no one can see one.
The answer to your question is, yes, it is a challenge, but I don't think we're going to be defeated by it. And let me give you some examples of how we might approach that. We're grappling with the issue you mentioned at the moment, because we're building a huge new gallery called Making Modern Communications, and it's really about the history of communications from the telegraph onwards. And of course, what's quite striking is most of that history is analog, not digital. And the analog objects are fantastically enticing because they sort of wear their heart on the outside in terms of, it's a bit like a Richard Rogers building. You can kind of see how it works. Well, first of all, the thing to bear in mind is a lot of the underlying scientific principles still remain true. And for example, one of my big obsessions is an extraordinary object called the Rugby Tuning Coil, which sent broadcasts to the British Empire in the 1920s and 30s. And it's a simply enormous 20-foot high object, which is a huge wooden frame wrapped around with copper tuning coils. And the thing about it is it's a very, very visible bit of technology, but also you can learn a lot about radio waves from it, and it's still very relevant. But when it comes to new technology, it's very difficult, because if you're not careful, what a science museum becomes is more like a design museum, where you just have lots of beautiful computers, and it just looks like a shop rather than telling you any science. So there are various techniques that museums increasingly use in this sphere. One is taking objects apart, but the other is, of course, film, video, demonstration objects, really trying to explain those principles. In terms of things like atoms, I think there are some very interesting techniques I've seen in some of the American science museums, where they've built rather beautiful models which inevitably simplify atomic structure but do rather brilliantly explain, for example, something that a scientist completely understands and a member of the public has no idea what you're talking about, which is the famous Standard Model. I mean, what on earth is that? It sounds like it's a car. And so, yeah, it is quite challenging. The other thing we're increasingly doing is working with actors and theatre companies to explain objects. And one of the big movements in the science world in the past 10 years, and it's true here, is we have lots of explainers in the galleries trying to engage with the public and guide them through some of the latest technology.
You've talked also about wanting to challenge your audiences more in the future. How do you hope to do that?
Well, what I mean by that is not that we should be gratuitously controversial, but we should, first of all, surprise them with some stories, but also talk about issues which no one else seems to be looking at in detail. So let me give you two examples. One is about history. So one of the things that I'm very keen to do is an exhibition in 2016, which marks the anniversary of Calder Hall coming online to the national grid. And the point about it is that there was a time, and our collections demonstrate this, when there was no ambiguity about the joys of civil nuclear power. Then it was seen, famously, I think it was Attlee, who said it would be too cheap to meter. And the point about it is that our audiences would find it fascinating because they would learn what went well and what went wrong and why we now have this ambivalence about nuclear power. And we all know that Britain needs to make some decisions, not only about renewable energy, but also about nuclear power. We don't have a very clear policy. And so this is something that our audiences would be provoked by. And you have to remember that I look back with a historian's mind. So the Science Museum did an amazing exhibition in 1937 that was a sensational hit with the public about a revolutionary bit of new technology that people were very disturbed by, and it was called the television. And so we're being true to our past. But another example is, for example, what we do about an aging population. And you would expect a science museum to have a lot to say in terms of not only biology, but also engineering and, you know, designing a society that's going to work. So when I say challenging, I don't mean just telling comfortable stories, also thinking about challenges ahead, and not saying science knows all the answers, but these are the kind of things that, for example, MIT are investigating.
One of the things the Science Museum must have already had some experience in sort of fairly difficult issues is how you square wanting to run certain exhibitions with the finances. And in the past, obviously, a lot of exhibitions have been sponsored by companies. You've had nuclear exhibitions sponsored by BNFL, the British Nuclear Company. You've had an energy exhibition sponsored by BP, and most recently a climate science exhibition sponsored by Shell. And that model inevitably leads to either perceptions that there is a bias in the exhibition that favours the company, or maybe there's something more than a perception. And how do you see that model? Is sponsorship necessary if you want to have certain exhibitions? And how do you deal with the problems that it does raise? You do draw criticism.
Yeah, it is a tricky area. And of course, I think it's even more complicated than you've described it. Because if you take, for example, the question of whether we should take sponsorship from major companies, the reality is that these organizations spending staggering amounts of money on science and research. And I think there were probably some environmentalists who would have been a bit concerned about some of the sponsorship. But of course, if you actually talk to these people, you realize that in fact, they're part of the solution, not the problem, because they have the science to look at, you know, energy consumption and a whole range of solutions. I suppose I would say a number of things in terms of how one safeguards the public, because the thing we're very concerned about is never misleading them. And the thing that is so difficult in a conversation like this is that I know, sitting in my intray, are many, many proposals that we've turned down because we felt that in the end it was more a PR push for a company rather than something of genuine public benefit. And of course the danger is that although I could show you that list, I could never really show you that list because I would then create a bit of a PR storm and some embarrassment. So so much of this is about integrity. And the other part of that is the thing that we are ruthlessly clear about, and I think our public do believe this about us, that we always retain editorial control. And so there are many, many things that people would have wanted us to put in the climate gallery that are not there because we didn't think the science was good enough or the story was correct. I think the other thing, which is a big lesson I've learned from the art museums where I come from, is one of the ways you balance the risk is that you don't just become dependent on company sponsorship. So the big reason why places like, you know, the Tate, the British Museum are very successful is a lot of individual philanthropists give money. And there's virtually no conflict of interest or perceived conflict because they're just straightforward philanthropists. So this museum, like most science museums in the world, is very much dependent on corporate sponsorship. I think that part of the way of dealing with the concern you raise is rebalancing a bit and finding other sources of income. But I think it's unwinnable. All I can say is that I know that in reality, the perceived risk and quiet corruption that people feel doesn't really happen.
I wanted to talk about one of the recent changes you've made at the Science Museum, this introduction of your research and public history department. And it sounds like that is doing something which I must admit I thought was always happening at the Science Museum, that this was research into your collections and research into your audiences and such like. Can you tell me what that department hopes to achieve?
Well, it's long overdue. And part of the reason for having this new department is to make sure that a lot of what we know becomes publicly available. If I can give you one example, we have an outstandingly superb program of audience research, which is deeply relevant not just to the museum, but in fact to the Department of Education, and indeed anyone who cares about how children or indeed anyone is going to understand science. And we've made the classic mistake of not really publishing this, which when you think about it is just ludicrous, because after all the taxpayer paid for this work to be done and it hasn't got into the outside world. So that's something I'm particularly passionate about because so many companies and government bodies do outreach work with schools, but the amount of evidence of what has an impact has not really been published very well, and that is ludicrous and really scandalous to some degree. In terms of other aspects of research, we are behind the art museums, and I think it goes back to something I mentioned earlier, which is that for a period, science history was out of fashion, strangely, in the science museum. And so people couldn't quite understand why we needed to do it. The reason, and I think I've explained it before, is we need to understand our collection because we will discover things very relevant to present-day dilemmas. Also, we've been fortunate at the time of announcing we were going to have a proper research department, we've had some wonderful joys and discoveries. So you might have been aware that last week we announced we've discovered in our media collection the world's first moving colour film. And, you know, that's one of those wonderful moments where had we not had a researcher, had we not had a gifted curator, a really major moment in kind of modern culture and British invention would never have been known. The other great thing, though, that is, I think, special about our research work is that we work with individuals who are part of that story. And so the great thing about our collections, it's not just about the person who invented the machine, it's also about the people who operated it. And I mentioned earlier our gallery about the history of communications. Well, of course, the people who operated manual telephone exchanges are still very much alive, with amazing stories that are riveting about social history. And, you know, engaging those people is, I think, a sort of moral duty in a way, because it gives you a really three-dimensional sense of science history and its impact.
Tell me something about the material these guys are working on, though. Are we talking about they are researching the objects and the iconic things on display, or are we talking about a lot of material that is almost behind the scenes?
I would say most of the work that needs to be done is on the collection behind the scenes. We have a simply astonishing store down in Wiltshire, where most of the large collection that is not on display is stored. And it's the great dilemma of all museums, of course, which is the question that museum directors are asked most, which is how much of your collection is on display. And the answer, by the way, is for us is about 5%. And that always confuses and puzzles politicians and business leaders and our public. And it's actually very easy to deal with if you really use the rest of the collection. And one of the ways you use it is by doing research and rotating the collection and doing exhibitions based on it. But if you don't do any of that, then there is no justification at all for having 95% in existence. So it's very much about an extra effort to bring all those unknown treasures to the fore.
So let's look at another one of those beautiful objects, Ian. Here's your second choice today.
So we're now standing in a new exhibition that opened recently, celebrating the life of Alan Turing. We're now standing between two objects that may appear to be unconnected. One is the first attempt to build physically Alan Turing's concept, which is the Pilot Ace, which briefly was the world's first computer, using the whole methodology that Turing conceived. Now, on the other side, we have a bit of wreckage from a Comet aircraft that crashed in the 1940s. And the point about this is that the two are connected in a way that is really rather moving, I think. So one of the big problems with early passenger aircraft is that their accident rate was very high. And we now know one of the reasons is that they had a major design fault, which is instead of having porthole windows, they had square windows because the designers wanted them to look different from standard shipping. The problem was that this meant that all the stresses went to the corners of the windows, and basically they exploded and the things kept crashing. But in order to really test this theory, which is now obvious but wouldn't have been at the time, the scientists who investigated this crash had to do an enormous number of calculations. Now imagine trying to do that with that team of women that we saw earlier. That would have taken forever. And imagine if there'd been an error through that process. In order to do this investigation, they used the Pilot Ace. So they were able to calculate the forces involved and look at the physics at a vastly greater speed. So it's fascinating how within a blink of the Pilot Ace existing, a use was found. And I think that's the wonderful thing about science generally, which is people are painfully literal about whether, for example, CERN matters. And actually, if you have any sense of history, it's really crazy to see science like that. That every time you find a new breakthrough in chemistry or biology or physics, there always will be, within a very short space of time, a fabulous practical application. So it's much better to think of it that way rather than always assuming you should only fund research if you know in advance what the practical outcome is going to be.
Looking at this Pilot Ace, I'm at a loss to understand how it works, or even actually what I'm looking at. It looks like a sort of a wall full of, I'm not sure, are they valves?
They are valves, exactly.
And you've got hundreds, probably.
Exactly. And they sort of switch on and off as part of a binary system, basically. I've also no idea how it works.
And this over here is
oh, the control
how you
pattern,
control
yes.
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which looks like a sort of something you'd find in a church, or maybe a church organ or a pew or something with a load of 1950s switches stuck onto it.
Exactly.
Absolutely extraordinary.
Exactly. And the other thing about it is that Turing got a bit bored with the project in a way, because trying to turn his ideas into this three-dimensional object was a very painful process. And although we regard this as Turing's object, and of course his ideas were behind it, you can see that turning it into a physical device like this was a painful and amazing process. I mean, clearly, not long after it was created, then technology moved on enormously. But the thing also which is wonderful about it, although you just said to me you look at it and wonder how it works, at least there's something you can look at. I mean, if you think that what we're looking at now is something that would be a fraction of what's the processing power on my BlackBerry, for example, it's really quite astonishing. It's a wonderful example of the old thing about Moore's law, and it really illustrates vividly how the computing capacity from the 1950s, which is this object, to the present day has moved at a rate that is simply spellbinding, I think.
Is the museum about more than making people want to be scientists?
If I can answer the question in a strange way, would anyone say to the director of the British Museum that their objective is to turn everyone into archaeologists? Or would everyone expect the Tate to turn everyone into painters? And clearly, we have amazing evidence that children come here and are inspired to become scientists. But one of the things that I'm very concerned about is that a lot of initiatives in schools and outreach are part of what I describe as the pipeline. It's the idea that the only reason all of this happens is that people must, at the end of it, decide to become scientists. And there are, I think, two real problems with that. And the first is, what do you mean by scientist? So one of the things that people who actually work in industry and the people actually making money in this country would say is that it's not just about people becoming research scientists working in some of the major laboratories. You know, Britain needs people who work in industry, and it needs technicians as well. So that's one immediate problem. But I think there's a much bigger problem, which is that what I want to achieve here is to do for science what the Tate's done for contemporary art. And what I mean by that rather strange description is I want people to be more literate in science. So even if someone here as a child does become interested in science, if they then decide at the end of it not to go into a research lab but to go into marketing or law, that's also great. What I want is just more people who care about science and love it. They don't have to be literal about it and at the end of it only have a couple of choices. And I think it demeans and destroys science if we think that it just has to have one tangible outcome.
There are, though, of course, plenty of objects around here, around the museum, that do inspire scientists. So let's have a look at your third choice, which I think a lot of people will be familiar with.
So we're now standing by one of the most iconic objects in the museum. And although I tried to resist talking to you about really obvious things in the collection, there is something here that is so loved by our visitors and also by me that it's, I'm afraid, irresistible. And that's the Apollo 10 capsule. And there are so many things to say about this, but I think the first is that when you look at it, the idea that we ever got to the moon is so implausible. And in fact, I've quite often stood here listening to children and adults talk about it. And the problem with displaying it, it reinforces the conspiracy theories, because they look at this and they find it utterly impossible to believe that we've ever escaped the Earth's gravity, because it basically looks like an upside-down colander with a bit of rust on it. And when you also look inside, it tells you something else, which I think visitors find quite overwhelming, which is how incredibly tiny the space is for the astronauts. And I also particularly wanted to show this to you because I'm working on a project at the moment to do something which has never really been done, which is tell the Russian version of the space race. So if you look at this and you think that the technology seems implausible and the personal bravery of the astronauts is incredible, when you look at the even earlier technology of the Russians, it really is a story of the most extraordinary bravery, almost madness, actually. The other reason why I think this object is interesting interesting is that when you talk, as I do, to lots of scientists, even if they're not working in physics or space exploration, they might well be, you know, biologists or chemists or working in things totally unrelated to what we're looking at. Almost all of them say that the thing that really hooked them as a kid was the idea of space. So it's fascinating how it, I think, it illustrates something that's true of great collections, which is that how you inspire people is sometimes not very obvious.
Ian, you're the director of this science museum and you presumably work long hours. No one's going to tell you off when you walk around here. Do you ever creep down and climb inside the Apollo 10 command module? Or you've got so many big toys here. Do you ever get a temptation if you've done it?
Well, that's a difficult question. Should I give you an honest answer or not? Well, for example, with this capsule here, we are allowed, because the object is on loan from NASA, to open it one day a year. And unfortunately, the last time we did it, I was away. And when I discovered this, I was pretty annoyed. And I said to the curator, come on, you know, I'm the director, sure you can let me in. And the great thing about curators is that they're the kind of people who've signed a solemn vow, and they really, 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 really care about their objects. So he basically said, no, director. So unfortunately, he's got the key. So all we've agreed, and I'm afraid I shouldn't say this in our democratic age, but I have said to him that the next time it's opened, I will be at the front of the queue. But the thing, by the way, that I'm told when you go inside, it's really smelly.
Walking around the museum, you see time passing before your eyes. You see a lot of these fantastic industrial machines. You see the transformation into the birth of computing, valve technology, and moving onwards. And these are enormous shifts in science and technology. And how are you going to really face what's coming in the next 5-10 years yourself as a science museum? And because that technological change will keep going apace, presumably.
Well, it's a great question. But first of all, one thing I should stress is that part of the answer is don't panic. What I mean by that is what I spend a lot of my time talking to real teachers who are teaching chemistry and physics and biology. And very often they come to the museum still to look at historic objects because there's still a lot of science to learn from them. So it would be a real trap to assume that the only way you can be relevant for modern school kids is to show them the latest technology. The old stuff really matters as well. Also, can you just for a second have some sympathy for me? Because can you imagine how daunting it is trying to decide what to collect and what to look at? Because the great danger is someone in 50 years might look back and say, you know, that Ian Blatchford collected some really rubbish stuff, and all the best stuff he ignored. So it's a real challenge. It's obvious now when you go around the museum that we have all the greatest highlights, but that's just hindsight. I mean, part of being a museum, which none of us really admit, but I will tell you, is it's luck that you get it right. But the way we deal with the latest kind of technology is that we experiment. So we have a number of events here. For example, last year we had a wonderful festival about robotics, where the leading robotic designers in Europe came to demonstrate their latest work. And by spending time with them, you do develop from personal experience, but also talking to scientists you respect, a sense of who of those really are important and who you ought to start collecting. And also the exhibitions, that's why they matter. So rather than do these strange commercial exhibitions, working with scientists who have, you know, temporary displays, we have a thing called Antenna, for example, where we look at the latest technology. The one that's on at the moment looks at how technologists are trying to find ways of gathering water, because, you know, water wars and water preservation is an enormous issue. So it's a challenge, but actually it's fun in a way. And we'll make mistakes, and when we do, we'll conceal them and pretend we haven't made them.
Ian, thank you so much for a fantastic day here at the Science Museum. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. In fact, I've enjoyed it so much, I might spend more time in my own museum in the future.
A huge thanks to Ian Blatchford, director of the Science Museum here in London. If you want to learn more, check out their website at sciencemuseum.org.uk. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.